Before launch, we had what was called the pre-launch planning shift. You guys were always asleep. I mean, you were sleeping. And so the pre-launch planning shift, the control is all down at the Cape. They're in charge, and they've got a checklist that's about this thick, and I kid you not, it's called the OMI. And then we've got a flight control team in Houston who's following along. Pretty much it's just following along, but there's a couple steps when we did what was called the abort light test. So, you know, when you get into Ascent, if there's something goes wrong, we would call an abort, and there is a switch on the flight director console that you'd arm, and then you'd push a button, and that's all. Everybody thinks that what that did was it told the computers to abort. All it did was light a light in the cockpit that told the commander to abort. So that confirmed the voice call that said we're going to abort our TLS or TAL or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, we had to test that. And the way the CAPE worked was incredibly precise, line by line. And it would say, flight direct, you know, Houston flight, arm the switch. And then it would be Houston flight, push the button, and the astronaut who was in the cockpit, one of these guys' teammates, the ask, Cape Crusader?
C-squared.
Yeah.
Crusader.
Yeah. Was in the cockpit, and they'd say, abort light A is on, right? And if you made a mistake during that time frame, everything came to a halt because the Cape never proceeded. There was no, oops, I just made a little error. Let me fix it. Oh, no. If you made an error, everything stopped until they determined exactly how the error occurred. The only thing that a pre-launch flight director could do was screw up and become absolutely well-known at the Cape for screwing up. And so it was the highest stress period in the control center pretty much prior to T-minus 9 minutes. And the Ascent guys never saw that.
And at T-zero, the solid rocket boosters light, and those are 3.5 million pounds of thrust each, plus each engine's putting out 465,000 pounds of thrust. So 7.5 million pounds of thrust. And you jump off the pad. I mean, it just, if you ever watch a Saturn compared to a shuttle, there's no comparison. The shuttle just kind of, you know, motors up. The shuttle jumps off. You're close to 150, 200 miles an hour by the time you clear the pad is how fast you're going. So it's about, in the cockpit, you're on your back, and it's about 2.6 Gs instantaneously. And, you know, I flew fighters, so I was used to pulling 9 Gs and stuff. But what was impressive about it is that you're accelerating straight up, and you think, I'm on a runway freight train. This thing has so much power. It's just really shocking to you. And then the solid rocket boosters are shaking. Of course, we have a job to do, so we're tracking trajectory and different things like that. And so you ride that for the first 2 minutes, and you're heading up. And then at about 2 minutes, the solid rocket boosters are spent, and they pop off the vehicle, and then it gets really quiet. And in the cockpit, it's completely quiet. The external tank still has a lot of fuel in it, so you're only at about 1G. So it's just you're feeling normal. But then as you keep going, as you accelerate faster and faster and faster, and that tank empties of fuel and oxidizer, then you start accelerating. And you accelerate to the point where you're back up to 3Gs, but when you get to 3Gs, the engines actually started throttling back to maintain 3Gs. And the reason they did that is, if they kept the throttles all the way up, at the end we'd be pulling 5 or 6 Gs, and to be able to survive that with a vehicle, you have to carry a whole bunch of extra structure on the vehicle. Well, we wanted to carry payload to orbit, so we throttled back so that we didn't have to carry the extra structure. And by the time you shut down the engines at 8.5 minutes, those throttles were already all the way back to about 67%, or what we called idle. And then, so idle, 3 Gs, you're coming up on Mach 25, about 17,500 miles an hour. And then the engines cut off, and you go from 3 Gs to zero gravity instantly, and it's all quiet. So it's quite a ride. Entry basically starts at the end of a mission. Typically, we would fly about a 2-week mission or so, depending on what the mission was. Basically, it starts about 9,000 miles away from where you want to land. All five of my landings were at Kennedy Space Center. And so you basically prepare, and you get suited up, and you do what's called a deorbit burn. And so you turn the vehicle so that it's flying backwards. And we had a couple of orbital maneuvering engines, and those engines would fire for about 3 minutes or so. And what's going to do is it slows the vehicle down just enough that it'll enter the atmosphere. And so And the whole process from that to landing is a little over an hour. And so fire the engines, do the deodorant burn, turn around, get set up in what's called entry attitude. We do a bunch of other things. We reconfigure the computers for entry into the final stages, make sure the crew's all strapped in and suited and ready to go. And then you just start falling first. So we're entering the atmosphere. There's still no air. You're doing Mach 25, but you have 0 knots of airspeed. And you're just falling, and you're falling, and you're falling, and you're falling. And you drop down to probably close to only like 50 miles high or so before you start feeling it. And one of the tricks we always did is we had like pencils in the cockpit, and I would just place a pencil for the crew right in front of me, and it's just floating. But as the G field starts coming on, even before you can feel it, that pencil just starts slowly dropping, just like this. I'm sure you did this, Jim, right? Watched it.
We had something similar.
What's that?
We had similar, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it dropped, and then it goes down, and then the G's start coming on. And I remember my first flight when we hit only about a quarter G, because you're used to zero gravity for days, and hit about a quarter G, and I felt really, really heavy. I mean, it felt awful. And it's like, what is this? What's holding me into this seat? And then as the G's come on more and more, by the time you get to 1G as you enter, you feel so heavy because you're not used to being in 1G that I remember my first flight when I landed and we stopped, I didn't think I could pick my legs up. They felt so heavy. And as it turns out, it's just a recalibration. I actually could pick my legs up, but it's really a trip. And then what you're seeing outside the windows is we're seeing temperatures of about, on the leading edges, of about 2,600 degrees. So really, really hot. But there's actually a bow wave in front of the vehicle because we're running at a really high angle of attack, like 40 degrees. The bow wave, if you go all the way out there, the temperature is like 10,000 degrees. And that's why it's a blunt body, because if it was a sharp body, you get much higher temperatures and we don't have materials that can survive it. And so, but what you see out the windows is a dull orange glow with the basically all the atmosphere around you on fire. And then out the top windows, which Jim, you probably saw, is the plasma flashes where it's just like a lightning storm kind of. I don't know, how would you describe it, Jim?
It was a pinkish orangish glow that came back over the windows. And I actually looked out the overhead window once, and it was like a cone that came to a point but then was truncated. It was cut off. It was like there was a circle there, and I imagine it was the airflow, that particular place where the plasma was just whacked off. It was really interesting looking.
Yeah. And so then you're flying this entry all the way in, and then you eventually get to about Mach 5, and you're kind of, it's almost starting to fly like an airplane, but not quite. When you get to about Mach 5, we deploy the air data probes, because we've been just running inertially this whole time, because air data probes would just burn off. But you need air data probes, because all we have is inertial, but we need the air data probes to give you your alpha and beta and airspeed for landing, just like you guys use in your airplanes. And so we would deploy those probes at Mach 5. We would take our data into the system at about Mach 2.5. And at Mach 2.5, there was a mode called terminal area energy management where the shuttle now starts flying like an airplane. Like when you roll it, it uses the body axis instead of what's called a stability axis that it was using before. And it starts flying like an airplane. And then you're flying that into, and then we did, if you're familiar with a... flame out approach for a single engine fighter where you circle overhead the field and do a big circle to land and control your energy. Essentially, that's what we did. We flew around what's called...
Give them the altitudes. Overhead,
oh, yeah, yeah.
90,
yeah, yeah.
Or 180, 90.
Yeah, yeah. So we would come in and we would fly this heading alignment cone, but it was essentially a flame out approach. But our overhead the field altitude was about 50,000 feet, a little over Mach 1. The 180 was, we used to call it 28 at the 180, is 28,000 feet. The 90 was 20,000 feet. And when we rolled out on final, your final approach was 14,000 feet and 7 miles from the runway. But your aim point, because remember I told you this thing glides like, well, it doesn't really glide, it just falls. So your aim point, when you're coming in on final, and by the way, you take over manually at about Mach 1. All things being equal, you take over manually. It's a manual landing only, so you got to manually fly it. And you come around, and when you roll out on final, you're in either an 18 or a 20 degree dive, depending on how heavy or light you are, and you're doing 300 knots down final. And so your aim point is actually 7,500 feet short of the runway. And so you're going fast, you're aiming short of the runway. We actually had pappies that were set at 18 or 20 degrees, so we're flying pappies, just like you fly, come in, and then at 2,000 feet, we would essentially start exchanging our airspeed for, our energy, transition that energy to reduce our sink rate. So we do what's called a pre-flare, and we start a pre-flare, and it's just a general pre-flare. And we're going from this 20 degree glide slope to about a 1.5 degree glide slope. And we're holding that, and you hit that or right at about 300 feet or so. And at 300 feet, you manually deploy the gear. And so now you have more drag, you're slowing down even faster. And then you fly this 1.5 degree glide slope to about 50 feet on the radar altimeter. And then you go into the final flare, and you're trying to touch down 2,600 feet down the runway at, depending on heavy or lightweight, 195 or 205 knots. And so that was the approach and what it was like. I could talk about this for like hours.
You really could.
This is complex.